Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
We wanted to do a little review. Well, I sprang this on Pablo, so he doesn't know yet. A little review first about the diagram. Remember that it was dictated around the 1888. And what I wanted to say was that the diagram is an advanced meditation technique. It's not something necessarily for beginners. However, it doesn't mean that there aren't things that we could do. And I mean mostly that I could do. I'm not an experienced meditator. I wouldn't call myself a good sitting meditator, but there is plenty that I can do to click my awareness in that I can start doing that until the sitting meditation part can catch up. So the first talk we did on this talked about the sitting meditation part, these first two lines. First, conceive of unity by expansion in space and infinite in time, either with or without self-identification. And then meditate logically and consistently on this in reference to the states of consciousness. And we talked about trying to expand our awareness, into something that is more spaceless, which is similar to something when we close our eyes, that darkness we could think of as that spacelessness, and also in timelessness. So we're not necessarily here, my body is not necessarily here at this point in time only, but it is everywhere. We said, it's in the future, it's in the past, it's in the present, it's everywhere. And although our concrete mind can't wrap itself around that, once we start thinking about it or putting our awareness on it more, then the abstract part of that will come in.
Yeah, and actually that's a real experience in whoever gets the mystical perception, and they call it frequently the eternal now. There is a state of consciousness where the three times are like present right there. That's the state of consciousness that is beyond time. We also discussed about the state beyond space.
Okay, the states of consciousness we talked about, and just real quickly here, is what we can do presently is we can think about we talked about opening ourselves up to nature or noticing nature. So we're noticing what's going on the physical level. Then what we're trying to do is pay attention or be aware of our emotions, and that we're doing on the astral plane or what happens in our dreaming state. So we're doing that while we're awake. We're paying attention to our emotions. And the last thing was we're paying attention to our thoughts. So we're really trying to just be aware of what's going on during the day. I know there's a class on Mondays about I Am That with Nisargadatta Maharaj. And one of the classes that I caught talked about paying attention to the times in our day where we're constantly in motion, you know, when my mind wants to do something or where I can't sit still or my thoughts can't sit still. So pay attention to that time. Pay attention to the time where I'm feeling lazy, where I just can't get the energy up or the motivation or the inspiration to do something. And then the third state was kind of to pay attention to that state of equanimity or where I feel there's an equilibrium or a balance. So that was the states of consciousness. Then last week we went on to the first acquisition. But I want to do a little segue here about going from point A to point B. This is a process, and hopefully what we will have done in these four talks is give this process that we can use at whatever point we are in our spiritual life or on our spiritual path. So first, what we need to do is we need to get our emotions and our thinking psychologically healthy. We're not doing ourselves any good trying to expand and think about these things, if our emotions are constantly negative, or if they're depressing emotions, or things like that. So for me, my understanding is that's where modern psychology comes in to play. Or even for me, it was the New Age movement. I found Theosophy through the New Age movement, where it really was about just taking that shift and trying to make things look different for us. And in my opinion, the New Age movement could take us only so far. I think we talk about it here later on about the perils of where that New Age, I am perfect, statements can take us. So I'll leave that. Do you want to jump in?
No, just that you were saying that's the first work we have to do. And then we can start working on a more spiritual level.
Right. And for me, that spiritual level came through Theosophy. Because what I was thinking for in that first stage is I had complete unity. I knew that this was all there was. It was non-dualism. The only thing that existed was me. Unfortunately, that me was my emotions, my thoughts, my needs, my desires. That's all I knew. So the next step was what I would call dualism, where I had to learn that there was a lower self, or a self that consisted of these thoughts, these emotions, these sensations, these desires, these memories, and that was separate from this higher self, the spiritual self that was unitive, that was eternal, that was timeless. So I had to learn about that separation. Then, and I think any deep tradition will take you to this place of non-dualism, where you know that all there is that higher realm, or that higher self, or that spiritual self, and all this other stuff is illusion. But I think it's a pathway, it's a process to get from one step to the other. If you tell me all there is, that's all you are. You're the absolute. You're God. I can't picture that as I'm, you know, having a breakdown because my kid didn't clean up his room before he went to school. So that I'm not thinking unitively that way. But so I think that that's the process.
So the idea with the diagram of meditation is to go through that process. This is for somebody that is already in with this basic idea that there is something that we are identifying with and that may not be our true nature, and want to go from that duality to a state of unity, but a spiritual unity, as Michelle was saying.
Okay. All right. So then the first week we did the sitting meditation on unity. Last week we did the first acquisition and the first deprivation, which was working on this unity in our daily life. So expanding ourselves, noticing nature, seeing more than the door handle and the steering wheel when we go somewhere. So that's what we talked about last week. So this week we'll do the second acquisition and the second deprivation. First, we put these quotes here to give an idea of what equanimity is. This first one I really liked, Krishnamurti. One of the things that I think that he really does good is he asks pointed questions. He doesn't give answers. He asks questions that make you think of more questions. And by that process, he's hoping that you will find the answers. So he says here, what is it that prevents total perception of this vast, complex existence? I see this whole field of life only in terms of pursuing pleasure. Does that prevent total perception? How can the mind see the whole of the field when there is only the search for pleasure? What is the factor of pleasure? Pleasure is always personal. So as long as the mind is pursuing pleasure as the me, how can I see this whole thing?
Yeah, that is, I think we can see it clearly in our lives that when we are too focused on pleasure in the sense of pleasant sensations, pleasant company, pleasant environment, then we tend to be self-centered. And there may be a situation that is not pleasant or an environment that is not pleasant, and that we need to relate to that if we can improve it and bring it back to the true order we do. And if not, it's part of life. But if we are too focused on the always looking the pleasure for in the things that we do, then we have an existence that is fragmented. And then everything that happens that is not pleasant becomes something wrong. And then we start trying to run away from the pleasure, and then we get caught, as we are going to see, in the psychological self and this pursuit for happiness, that because of the very fact that we are pursuing it, we will never get it. As we are going to see, that true happiness comes when we can go beyond the pleasant and the unpleasant, because both things are realities in life, that we cannot shun one without shunning the other.
Okay, Nisargadatta says here, the personal self, by its very nature, is constantly pursuing pleasure and avoiding pain. The ending of this pattern is the ending of the self. The ending of the self with its desires and fears enables you to return to your real nature, the source of all happiness and peace.
That's the second sentence. It's very interesting. The ending of this pattern is the ending of the self. We saw that the personal self is this process of seeking pleasure. So when there is suffering in our life for any reason, there is a natural reaction to it and to try to seek pleasure, be it by drinking, by going out, by blaming somebody. In some way, the natural reaction of this process that is a psychological self is to seek for pleasure. So the very fact of staying with the suffering begins to break this process, because the process is the opposite. It is not staying with the suffering. So in the spiritual life, it is a very important aspect to learn to relate to suffering. Not that we have to inflict suffering to ourselves purposefully, which some religions do, because they get this insight that suffering is breaking through this personal self. So then what they start doing is to inflict suffering to themselves to try to break the personal self. This happened in Christianity, in Hinduism, in with the Muslims, the fakirs. And so that is, but when you do it on yourself, then it is the psychological self that is looking for something in doing it. You are tricking yourself. You are inflicting pain on yourself because you are expecting to gain peace, happiness, freedom. So it is still the pursuing of pleasure. But life brings us enough suffering not to have to punish ourselves. So whenever life brings suffering, instead of running away from it, many traditions recommend, including the Theosophical, is to embrace that suffering and let that suffering work on you like an alchemical process. Instead, you just watch it. There is suffering there. There is a tendency to run away from it. Just stay aware of the suffering and watch it, feel it. Again, not in a masochist way, but because it is the reality that is there, and you just watch it. When we are happy, we are not trying to run away from happiness. We enjoy the happiness in the sense that we are fully aware of the pleasant feeling. Well, the same, and equanimity, as we are going to see, is part of this. The same attitude we should have with suffering. If suffering is there in consciousness, we pay attention. And you'll see that will produce a transformation. That produces a transformation because it stops the process of the lower self.
You need not forget when desire and fear end, bondage also ends. It is the emotional involvement, the pattern of likes and dislikes, which we call character and temperament, that create the bondage. Okay, and that's just more of what you said.
More about it.
Yeah. Okay, so here we go. So that's basically what equanimity is. Or some examples, or why we should work on it. And then we go to the second acquisition. The normal state of consciousness must be molded by a continued attempt at attitude of mind to all existing things, which is neither love, hate, nor indifference. Different in external activity to each, because each in each the capacity alters, mentally the same to all. From this arises a state of equilibrium and constant calm. This leads to greater ease in practicing the virtues, which are really the outcome of wisdom for benevolence, sympathy, justice, etc., arise from the intuitive identification of the individual with others, although unknown to the personality. First, what I want to say is what we talked about last year. The first part is what we can work on in meditation. And I do want to say on this first part that which is neither love, hate, or indifference, if we put likes and dislikes in there, it really seemed for me to make much more sense than love. Because when we talk about getting rid of love, the first thing our mind goes to is, oh, what am I not supposed to love my kids or my husband or my parents? So love and hate are kind of at the ends of the continuum, where likes and dislikes, we can do that. There are things that we like and we dislike all the time, that we choose one over the other. So when those two words were switched in, it really made a lot more sense for me. So this,
that's what she meant by love and hate, not the spiritual love or the deeper love, but just, oh, I love this, I hate this, you know, right. Likes and dislikes. Now, so the attempt is to have this kind of attitude. Now, if we say we have to generate this attitude that is not of like or dislike, most people would fall into the option of indifference. The easiest way to proceed with this is just to retreat, to stop caring, to stop paying attention, you know, to come inside. And that is what many religious people do, and monks and in different traditions, they produce this retreat from the world. That is never the theosophical approach. It may have its own purpose, its own results, but in the theosophical approach, and you will see it in several places here, the idea is to transcend these attitudes without stopping being engaged in the world, which is more difficult than just retreating from the world. So what is there if you don't have an attitude of like, dislike, or indifference? What is there? Yes, I'll repeat what you said. Yes, go on.
What's there is sort of an objective interest.
Okay, repeat it, just there, yeah.
An objective interest in what is happening.
Yeah, I agree. It's the state of attention. You know, something happens and you are aware of it. And you are aware in an objective way without reacting. The problem is that because we don't have the state of equanimity, then if we are aware of something, there will be a reaction. Therefore, we don't want to be aware of certain things, and usually the unpleasant things. But this is a process. The idea is start getting engaged in the sense of being aware objectively. If reactions appear, be aware of the reactions and don't react to the reaction. Watch the reaction with equanimity. So there is, I see something unpleasant, and there is a tendency not to pay attention to that because I don't want to feel bad. And then this tendency appears, or this feeling, and then you watch that feeling appearing, and then you are keeping your equanimity, even if there is an attitude of dislike, because when you start watching it, you get above it. So the act of being aware makes you be beyond whatever is there. So even if there is an attitude of dislike, when you are aware of it, you as consciousness are in a state of equanimity. And the mind may be reacting with dislike, but that is not a problem.
Okay, and then the second part, the different in external activity to each, because in each the capacity alters, mentally the same to all. And that's where
So that's the same, you know. Mentally, we have to try to have this attitude of unity, but externally, things are different. So if we are going to be engaged in the world, things will be different. There is this story in Hinduism that I don't remember what king, a sage king, I don't know if it was Rama or who was, but he was supposed to be a sage. And there were some yogis or swamis that were jealous, and they didn't know if this person was really a sage. And there is a part in the Bhagavad Gita that says the sage sees a cow, a dog, a sage, all in the same way. So they bring to the king, you know, a dog, a cow, a sage, and see what he does to test if he was really seeing the unity behind. So he said, okay, take the cow to the shed, the dog with the animals, and the sage to my courts. So then these people say, ha, you see, you are not really enlightened because you are making a difference. And the king said, so what do you want me to do? To send the sage to eat grass, to send the dog to my court? You know, so that's the idea. Externally, things are different. People are different. We may have to relate to one person in a different way to another person. But we have to learn to do that externally while we keep this attitude of unity. Again, it's the same as the above, and it's not easy to do, but that is the real transformation, when little by little we get to act in this way.
Okay, and then, so that second one is the concept, okay, that's the ideas. And then this third part here is the result, what it looks like when we can get to this point. Do you want to?
Yeah, just reread it.
From this arises a state of equilibrium and constant calm. This leads to greater ease in practicing the virtues, which are really the outcome of wisdom, for benevolence, sympathy, justice, etc., arise from the intuitive identification of the individual with others, although unknown to the personality.
Yeah, that's also interesting. That so she says, if we are in a state of calm, it's far easier to be virtuous, because a virtue is not something that you actively try to impose on yourself. As we said last week, our natural state is a state of virtue, this courage we were talking about. When you get rid of fear, what is left there is an action where there is no fear. We call it courage, but it's just a natural state where fear there is not there. So what prevents any virtue is this self-centeredness, is this being focused on my pleasure, and therefore I will act in ways that even if they damage some other person or the environment, I still do it because I'm focused on myself. So if we are in this state of calm awareness and we are not caught up in the self, then there is this sense of feeling, or this feeling of unity, as it says, the individual identifies with others. And from that, there is a natural virtuous action, you know, just because we feel one with, or we are not so self-centered. So that's also an interesting statement.
Okay, so some quotes to identify with the second acquisition. This is from The Voice of the Silence. Be like the ocean, which receives all streams and rivers. The ocean's mighty calm remains unmoved. It feels them not. And then Mabel Collins here, she wrote Light on the Path, but this is from her commentaries, or the commentary in there. Because before the eyes can see, they must be incapable of tears, is from Light on the Path. And then her comment to that is, to be incapable of tears is to have faced and conquered the simple human nature, and to have attained an equilibrium which cannot be shaken by personal emotions. It does not imply any hardness of heart or any indifference. And then the last one from The Voice of the Silence is, both action and inaction may find room in thee. Thy body agitated, thy mind tranquil, thy soul is limpid as a mountain lake. This, I like this last quote, because I think that I should feel calm. My body should be calm. My emotions should be calm. My thoughts should be calm in order for me to be able to affect and then calm everything around me. But that's not it at all. So when I read this, and I think you had a different meaning to it, so you can explain it, but thy body agitated. I'm always agitated. Something's always agitated. Something's always moving, it seems like. And so if I know that that's okay and that I can find that calmness, those gaps in there, then my soul or that higher self can start affecting those other things. It doesn't happen the opposite way, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, so it's always the difference between the state of consciousness and what happens to the vehicles of consciousness. In the Yoga Sutras, Patanjali says that the main problem, the root of the suffering and illusion, is that our consciousness gets identified with the vehicle of expression. So the body is the vehicle through which consciousness expresses at the level of actions. The emotions is a vehicle of expression at the emotional plane, and the mind on the mental plane. So the idea is that even if the body is agitated or is working or is even reacting, you can generate this state of awareness where there is a part of the mind that is always calm, even if the lower mind is reacting, or the emotions, or the body. When you are in a state of awareness, there is a point that is calm, and on that point of calmness, the soul can be reflected. And that's what happens when you watch, if your personality is reacting and you watch it, that point of awareness that is watching it becomes a communication from the soul to the personality, so to say. So the influence of the soul comes down and produces order in consciousness. So that is part of what this verse means.
Okay, the Mahatma letters tell us, it is upon the serene and placid surface of the unruffled mind that the visions gathered from the invisible find a representation in the visible world. Otherwise, you would vainly seek those visions, those flashes of sudden light, which have already helped to solve so many of the minor problems and which alone can bring the truth before the eye of the soul. It is with jealous care that we have to guard our mind plane from all the adverse influences which daily arise in our passage through earth life. The last sentence here, when it says to guard our mind place or with jealous care, that we really have to work hard or work persistently on what influences are coming in. Many things we don't have any influence or any control over. It's out there and we're affected by it. But there are things as far as what we read or what we listen to or what we watch or if we can, who we hang out with or where we hang out. So those things we can. And then also it's really hard to say, no, I can't listen to you gossip, or no, I can't gossip, because it's not good for my mind. You know, I think, well, I can just listen and it will just bounce off. But it really is something that we have to take to heart in order to start, you know, along this process.
Yes, as we are saying, if we can be in a state of awareness, then there is a connection to the higher in us. If our mind is being constantly disturbed...
Or polluted.
Yeah, or polluted, then it is harder to do it. So we are not educated in this way. We may be educated that we shouldn't do certain things. We are focused on the body and shouldn't go to certain places or do certain things because they are not good for us. But then we think that what we feel or think doesn't really have an effect on us. And it's the opposite. If we have the right mental attitude, we could even go to physical places or do physical things that would not really affect our nature if we have the right mind about it.
The right substratum. That's what she's talking about in that in the notes, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
where she talks about the substratum. That's what we're looking for to strengthen or to clear the dust away from, so that we can act from and think from and feel from that substratum of unity.
Yeah. So I always say, to me, there is like this sense of sacredness. Your awareness, your field of consciousness is sacred. It reminds me this passage in the Gospels where Jesus expels, you know, all the money makers that were in the temple, and he said, "This is a sacred place. What are you doing here?" That is exactly how we should feel about our field of consciousness. It's a sacred place. When you let in all these kind of thoughts or emotions that are negative, you are polluting your own sacred space. And of course, that doesn't mean that as Michelle said, we are exposed to many things in life, and that is fine. The thing is that when something comes in, you watch it, you are aware of it, and you say, you know, I see you, but I don't want you as my neighbor. I don't want you here. So you just gently let it go and place your mind somewhere else. You know, try to preserve this sacred space, and that will help a lot in going through life with a higher consciousness, in more connected to our higher nature.
And just a little anecdote to that. You know, sometimes we very purposefully choose where to live or where to work or what we do. And then life throws us those curveballs. I moved here about six, seven years ago, and I was always a not so good vegetarian. And then over the last couple years, I got to be a really good vegetarian, which means I didn't cheat with White Castles and a Coke on those stressful days. But, and even to the point where my kids will say, "No, Mom, you can't do that. You can't cheat anymore." And so I, you know, I was so proud I was doing that. Well, I recently got a job where my one of my duties is to cook, and I have to cook meat. And you can't cook and not taste, because you don't know how much of what is in there. So I kind of got to the point where I chuckled over the irony of it. You know, here I live on the Theosophical Society, where we don't cook meat, we don't, you know, have it in the house, we don't, and to the point where, you know, I have to cook, and it tastes really good. You know, it's not like I don't like meat, it tastes really good. So,
but this is an example of what I was saying. It is more important the frame of mind. I mean, I'm vegetarian since 20 years ago. I'm very strict, but I don't think that vegetarianism is the essence of the spiritual practice. You know, there are some reasons why I think it helps the spiritual practice, and it helps also the environment and animals, etc. But some people put all their attention in being vegetarian, eating well, and don't put any attention in their emotions and thoughts. And the emotions and thoughts are far more destructive for the spiritual life than what you eat. So we have because we are educated to perceive the concrete, we have this upside down view of things, where we think the body is the most important and the rest is kind of, you know, something that is not real. But if we are in situations where we have to deal with people or situations or habits that we don't like, still the most important thing is our inner state. And that is, you know, where life puts us at the time, and we have to take it and go through it in the best possible way. And our inner attitude is far more important than the external attitude. Many times we cannot choose what life brings us. And there is an order in the universe, and if something comes and we don't like it, well, equanimity. You know, life has a purpose, or at least that's what I think, that everything has a purpose. You take it in the best possible way, and your spiritual practice goes on in spite of the negative, you know, situation.
And okay, this last quote here, Annie Besant talks about the dangers of going to the other extreme. So she says, "I must warn you here of a danger. there is a rough and ready way of quickly bringing about dispassion. Some say to you, kill out all love and affection, harden your hearts, become cold to all around you, desert your wife and children, your father and mother, and fly to the desert or the jungle. Put a wall between yourself and all objects of desire. Then dispassion will be yours. It is true that it is comparatively easy to acquire dispassion in that way, but by that you kill more than desire. You put round the self, who is love, a barrier through which he is unable to pierce. You kill love and not only desire.
Yeah, that's part of what we were talking. It's easier when we deal with all these things, the easiest is to retreat, to put up a wall, all these things. But unfortunately, that doesn't work. We have to be, Krishnamurti always talked about being vulnerable. If we are vulnerable, that means that the psychological self is not generating these defenses. So be vulnerable in the sense that if you are feeling desire, don't put up a wall. Just watch it, work with it. Know, learn, listen to the story. Why do you want this? Try to think where it will lead you. Is it going to give you what you really are looking for? So instead of putting up a wall, is a renunciation to understanding, to awareness. It's closing up. The opposite is needed. It's more difficult because then we open up to all these things that produce an impact in us, but it's what is going to produce a real transformation. So open up and work with whatever comes into the field of consciousness.
Okay. These next two quotes here talk about chelaship and enlightenment. And although we tend to be a little bit further from it than we'd like, there is still so much that we can do that kind of is relative in speaking. You know, if when we are a chela or when we are enlightened, these are the things what they will look like. But down here or here and now, there are still things that I can work on that are the same things that are needed then.
Yeah, and these ideas shows us the direction in which we have to go. So we don't, it doesn't matter how far we are from that at the moment. It shows the direction of the walking, and you just, you know, try your best in that direction.
So Madame Blavatsky says in Collected Writings, among the qualifications expected in a regular chela is a calm indifference for, but a just appreciation of, everything that constitutes the objective and transitory world. Go ahead. I was just going to say, here she's saying again, don't leave this world. You know, the world we live in is our best teacher.
Yeah, again, you see a just appreciation of. Again, there are traditions in which the strategy is just not even look at the world. And that may work also, but this is rooted in what the theosophical path seeks. The theosophical path seeks to generate people who not only perceive unity, but who can be in the world, helping in whatever way that they can for others to also perceive unity. That's like an activist kind of spirituality. There are other paths that are more mystical in a sense, that the idea is to retreat from the world and to stop coming back to the world. And of course, I think that people who go that through that path, they also help the world just by the very fact of being outside the illusion that produces a change in human consciousness, because human consciousness is one. We are all part of the same consciousness. But the Theosophical Society, the path that it encourages is the one where the person can still be involved in the world, trying to help on this plane too. So that's why I think there is also this emphasis on not simply retreating, but being able to work in the world.
The Mahatma letters tell us, what better path towards the enlightenment you are striving after than the daily quest of conquest of self? The perseverance in spite of want of visible psychic progress, the bearing of ill fortune with the serene fortitude which turns it to spiritual advantage. Since good and evil are not to be measured by events on the lower or physical plane, hold a calm and brave spirit toward outward events in the present and a hopeful spirit for the future on all planes.
Yeah, this also has a lot of interesting things. But again, here there is the other aspect of why we are advised to stay in the world, because the idea is that the world is what exposes us to what we really, or what we are at the moment. So I may imagine that, you know, I'm one with everything, but then when I have to relate to a person that is unpleasant, then I see how much I am identified with, you know, my seeking pleasure or not. So the world is, as Krishnamurti used to say, the relationship is a mirror where we see where we are at. At a certain point, you begin to recognize that all that are the, you know, the vehicles of consciousness reacting, and you can have this state of awareness. But then that you really are in this state of awareness when you have to actually do it, not think about it. When there is this unpleasant person, you see your body reacting and you are making an effort to stay aware of what is going on. So life itself is a spiritual gym where you develop this ability to not to identify with the lower. But then also the Mahatma says there, we judge everything for what happens on the objective plane, the physical plane. So again, we say, oh, this is bad because it produces me, you know, some kind of sorrow. But he says that the physical plane is a shadow of the real, and something that can be very inconvenient down here, it may be exactly what consciousness needs, because it's trying to break through through something. So the idea is that we have to go through whatever life puts us with this calm state or serene fortitude, as he says, and that produces a spiritual power, that produces this strength, this inner strength, that nothing from the outside can shake. And that is the true equanimity.
Okay, the second deprivation.
So this was the, what?
Go back to the slide, yeah. I want to see you
okay.
The balance for a while.
Okay, feel it.
So that's all the equanimity. Right. So far we saw the second acquisition, that was the state of calm, neither like nor dislike, nor indifference. And now the deprivation, the things that we have to let go of.
Constant refusal to think of reality of the distinction between friend and foe, resulting in the absence of anger and bias, replaced by judgment. And this judgment isn't the judgment that we're trying to get rid of, it's the judgment
that's... To be judgmental now.
Right, yeah, we're not trying to be judgmental. We are trying to be discernful. Discern. You have discern. Use discernment. So that's what that means there. You want to just go right to the quote?
Little... Yeah, well, just as we said, it's a constant refusal to think of the reality of this, you know, that somebody is my friend because I like him or her
or she's nice to me. I find myself, if you're nice to me, oh, you're my best friend. I would do anything for you. And if you're not so nice, then I don't want to have anything to do with you. And it is so hard to break away from that and to say, I think there's a quote in here that says, nobody's friends or foes, we're all each other's teachers. And if you put it that way, it might be a little easier to take that. But I know that, especially since doing this part of the talk, I noticed so much more about my distinction of friend and foe, or who can help me and who can't help me, and that kind of thing. So, yeah. So what's important, again, is that constant refusal to think of reality of. That friend and foe is going to be there. Our attachment to likes and dislikes are going to be there to that friend or foe. But It's that nanosecond that we think that we can say, hey, no, this isn't real, this isn't the way it is, and I refuse to think of it as that. And then hopefully it can trickle on down to where we are more equanimical towards people. I don't think I would ever treat anybody different, you know, if whether it's a friend or a foe, if they ask me to do something. But I know my mind is just going very high speed, you know, when their physical situation is removed, and I have to think about what I'm doing. So
yeah. So here again, you see that the distinction of friend and foe is based on our need to seek for pleasure, pleasant relationships, people that help us out. Of course, it doesn't mean that if there is an unhealthy relationship of violence that you have to stick to it. Again, this is, as Blavatsky said, you have to have the right appreciation of what the situation is. But internally, you have this view that whatever happens, as we are going to see, is part of a process of learning or developing a skill or you know, developing the ability to be beyond the reactions. And that the distinction that the mind makes is just based on whether the mind likes it or not. It's not based on a reality. And then if we don't expect things from people or situations, then we don't get angry about the situations, or we don't get biased that because I like this person, I will do something that is not right, something wrong, but because I will benefit this person that I like, or I will do something wrong, but because I don't like this person. So the bias disappears.
And what I just thought of, one of the things I got from the New Age movement is Neil Donald Walsh wrote a book for kids called The Little Soul in the Sun, I think it was. And in part of it, he talks about, you see one page, you see these two kids, and they're playing together, and they're friends. And then in the next page, you see one of the kids putting on this dark suit. And what the explanation or the idea is, the one little boy says, "What are you doing?" And he says, I'm your teacher. You know, as you are my teacher, you helped me out in the past. I am your teacher this time. But remember that I love you. Remember always that I love you and I am, you know, part of you. And so he puts on this black robe and he's going to be some point in this person's life, some karma in this person's life that causes suffering. Now, that's a really nice story and it's a really nice image, but I think right at the time that it's happening, it's hard to feel that is my friend or that is my teacher. And I don't think that's, obviously that's the ideal, but I don't think that's practical for me to get to beat up myself about thinking, oh no, I don't think it's my friend. I don't like this person and I want to get away from it. Eventually that will happen with the awareness.
Yeah, but again, when that happens, we become aware of the lower self or the psychological self in us feeling all this. The idea is not to repress, not to try to force with violence to feel differently from what we feel, but to recognize, as Michel said, if you start working on the diagram of meditation or anything like this, it begins to be like a point of attention. You begin to notice when your mind is doing this, just because since you are working on this, you have it present. So the idea of studying all this is not to try to force yourself into something you are not. It's to have these concepts present and actually see what happens in life and become aware of it and try, see if you can let it go. If you cannot see why, you know, feel the pain, feel the suffering with this embracing awareness and let it tell you the story. Because many times our things are really are not based on something objective or very important on the objective plane, or sometimes it's very objective. But whatever the case, you can always learn to, by watching, to generate this space, or the space is generated by itself.
Did you have a question?
Or a comment?
A comment?
Wait for the mic. Yeah, here.
I think all of these meditations basically is pointing out the difference between the way the mind sees the world and awareness sees the world. Mm-hmm. And we have both points of view available to us if we notice it.
Right, mm-hmm. That's a really good way to put it.
Yeah, and that's what something else I wanted to add. When you see a person that is your foe because you are having problems, and it's difficult to see how at the same time that person can be your friend, like in the story. If you switch, try to switch, even if it is in imagination at the beginning. But the idea of the higher self is no higher self has anything evil in itself, because in reality there is nothing evil and the higher self is the reality. So anything that is evil or wrong or bad is part of matter, so to put it, if we talk about spirit and matter, are things that are accumulated on the true consciousness. It's the same with us. Fear is not in the higher self. It's in the personality, something that is accumulated there. So if you can try to switch your point of view and think that this person that is doing this is not the real in the person that is doing this. The higher self of the person is one with you. There is, at the level of the higher self, there is this love as with the more than with the person that you love the most on the physical plane. And that higher self, or higher ego, as we say in theosophy, is the first victim of the personality, of the wrong things that the personality is doing. So it may be a little easier to see that even though the personality may be doing something wrong and hurtful, the real in the person is not doing it. The real in the person is a victim as much or even more than you are in that sense. So that may be a way to begin to perceive this. Raise your consciousness to the real in you and in another person, and it's a little easier.
Okay. All right, some quotes. From Mabel Collins again. Learn to look intelligently into the hearts of men from an absolutely impersonal point of view, otherwise your sight is colored. Therefore, impersonality must first be understood. Intelligence is impartial. No man is your enemy. No man is your friend. All alike are your teachers. Your enemy becomes a mystery that must be solved even though it takes ages. For man must be understood. Your friend becomes a part of yourself, an extension of yourself, a riddle hard to read. And I think that just illustrates what you just said. Mm-hmm. Follow the wheel of life. Follow the wheel of duty to race and kin, to friend and foe. And close thy mind to pleasures as to pain. Exhaust the law of karmic retribution. From Voice of the Silence.
So here again, the idea that the unpleasant things that come to you in life is part of the karmic causes generated by previous personalities or previous lives in which you as the higher ego try to express on the physical plane. So whatever comes to you is part of this karmic process. And what it says is, okay, you have to go through this, try to generate this state of mind of calmness and go through it. And with awareness, as with all that we said, and after the experience, even if it was a sorrowful experience, you will be enriched. Not you as a personality, but the real in you will be enriched in the sense that this awareness or this strength will be more manifested.
And remembering that the personality are those elementals, you know, that are surrounding us, that they're only reacting. They're not who we are. Okay, so Mabel Collins says here in a footnote, do not fancy you can stand aside from the bad man or the foolish man. They are yourself, though in a less degree than your friend or your master. But if you allow the idea of separateness from any evil thing or person to grow up within you, by doing so, you create karma, which will bind you to that thing or person till your soul recognizes that it cannot be isolated. Remember that the sin and shame of the world are your sin and shame, for you are a part of it. Your karma is inextricably interwoven with the great karma. And before you can attain knowledge, you must have passed through all places, foul and clean alike. Therefore, remember that the soiled garment you shrink from touching may have been yours yesterday, may be yours tomorrow. And if you turn with horror from it, when it is flung upon your shoulders, it will cling the more closely to you. The self-righteous man makes for himself a bed of mire. Abstain because it is right to abstain, not that yourself shall be kept clean.
Yeah, that's also a beautiful writing that has a lot of ideas that you can meditate on later. But again, the same idea is, you know, things that happen are part of the universal order, and we are ultimately speaking, we are all one. And ties of or hate and love, they both generate magnetic ties. So if I hate somebody or some situation, I will be brought back to that person or situation, because the very fact of hating something means that we have not understood it. It's like if you are training a sport person in any sport, and that person cannot do a certain aspect of the game, what are you going to do? You are going to make that person face that situation once and again until gets it right. So something similar, we can take that as a metaphor with life. When we hate something, situation, people, thing, that means that we don't see the reality right. And we will be exposed to that until we can pierce through the illusion and see the reality. So equanimity is a way to stop generating this kind of karma. We go through things with this wide awareness. We try to learn to do the best we can. And in that way, we don't generate this karmic circle.
Okay, the last two quotes from the Secret Doctrine commentaries. He who wants to be an occultist has not to separate himself from anything in this world. And the moment he separates himself from any vessel of dishonor, he cannot belong to any vessel of honor. It is a perfect impossibility.
So here the same concept.
To merit the honorable title of theosophist, one must be an altruist. To merit the honorable title of theosophist, one must be an altruist above all, one ever ready to help equally foe or friend, to act rather than to speak, and urge others to action while never losing an opportunity to work himself.
So the word theosophy means divine wisdom. And a real theosophy is not a member of the Theosophical Society. It's a person in which the divine wisdom is active. Normally, we judge from our mind. But there is this divine spark, or there is this divine awareness that is what we truly are. And a theosophist, a real theosophist, is the person in whom this divine wisdom has more and more influence. So the idea here, Blavatsky says, that to merit that title, to be a real theosophist, is to be able to work, to act in this way. And again, this is like the ideal. Let's walk in that direction with whatever we are at the moment, and work with what comes up. We may not be able to help equally foe and friend, but when we are in those situations and we see the bias or the resistance, then we work on that. We watch it and everything that we said.
And we can think to ourselves, why are we not helping mm-hmm. both foe and friend? There may be some objective reason that it's not healthy for us to do that. But is it coming from it'll be harder, I really don't feel like it, or I just don't like this person. So those are all distinctions. And then the last comment I have is just I believe it's the Mahatma letters. I have something that pops up on my phone every morning at 9 a.m. that just says, try and become. And that's all we can do. I get up every day and I try. Mm-hmm. And I fail. And I try again.
Yes, okay. And the The idea with this also is that when something happens, what I was saying about all these ideas and etc., when something happens, we should not judge ourselves whether we are doing right or wrong, whether we are good or bad at this. That judgment is part of the lower self. So just be what you are and work with what you are and try to do your best and then forget it. And next time, try to do your best again and forget the result. The result is not important because the result is conditioned by the past. But if you try to do the best, you are producing a better future. And the better future may be the next second, not the next life necessarily. So all that matters is try to do your best. And the result doesn't matter if you were, you know, try to do your best.
And I think there's a real, I'll put this up, our balance one. I think there's a real, there's an energy behind all of this, because I think, okay, if I make a mistake or I fail and I've hurt somebody, well, that person's going to be hurt by me forever. And, or if I embarrass myself or something like that, that this is what, you know, is going to be with me, I take with me forever. But I really think, or I hope, that there's an energy behind it that is very forgiving. Because I don't think try and become, or just the word try, because it's very important in the Mahatma letters that that's what we do, is try. We get up and try, and we keep trying, and we keep trying. If there wasn't this forgiving energy behind, or whatever you might call it, this forgiveness behind it.
Yeah, so. Yeah. The idea is always that a spiritual person is not expected results. It's expected to try, honestly. And that's even natural. When you are training your children into anything, you don't expect right results. You expect him or her to try, and then will fail and try again. If it's trying to learn to write and write wrong, you don't come and punish the person. You know it's part of the process. That all he has to do is to try again. So the same with this. We are with a person that is unpleasant. We remember this. We try to relate with, you know, this equanimity, and we can't. Well, so what? Try it next time. You tried it. That's all you have to do. Next time, try it again, and then again, and don't think of the result.
Yes, we have some questions from online.
Oh.
Three of them, actually.
Go ahead.
So the first one is... if someone you love is diagnosed with a serious illness/disease, explain, how do you practice equanimity?
Well, I would say, and I was actually going to talk about that, there are certain situations in life that are very hard to act in this way. And there are many other little situations that are easier. But when we talk about this, our mind always goes to the extremes. So when we talk about friend and foes, we tend to think about that person that ruined some aspect of our life. But we don't see that there are many other little situations, a person that is just annoying to us. Or, you know, we don't apply to that because we know that we could do it. But we know that in these extreme situations, it would be very difficult to do it. So what I always say regarding this is we have to start with whatever is attainable to us, whatever is easier. If you have not been trying to live in this way, then the situation described will probably be very difficult to face with equanimity because it's very complex. There are many things involved there. So I personally would try to do my best, but would not expect at all to be able to go through that with equanimity. I would be putting my attention to be in this state of equanimity in the smaller things in life, because these situations, smaller situations, are the ones that will generate enough strength to be able to do it eventually, even in those situations. So what I always say regarding these extreme, you know, situations. If you are going through this and you can't go with equanimity, it's only normal, only right. natural. But if you start working on the little things in life, eventually you may get the strength to go through this with sadness, with love, with all those things are natural, but with this inner sense of poise. You know, obviously, if you are losing somebody you love, there will be sadness there. It's perfectly natural. But there may be sadness with desperation, or there may be sadness with a certain poise. Now, again, that happens with trying to live in that way in our daily life.
And I think right when immediate, if you're getting hit in the head with a 2x4, there is no mental consciousness that you can come up with that's going to make that, you know, okay. But you can get through it. My son was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when he was 12. Now, I am a freak about diet. He never had ice cream. He always got the plain cone. He thought that was ice cream cone till he was 5. And, you know, I didn't feed him milk. Everything that you're not supposed to do to get diabetes, I did. And when if you would have told me that at 12 he was pregnant, I would have been able to process that at 12, that what
when
was going...
When you were pregnant.
No.
I didn't understand.
Yeah, sorry. When he was diagnosed at 12 with type 1, they got it, with type 1 diabetes, I couldn't process that. There was no way. There was nothing I did wrong. If you would have told me he was pregnant, I could have found a way to figure that out. So, and I went through, it took me 1 month to go through the process of what's going on. It's all my fault because I'm his mom. I did this one thing, and I went through this whole process. And then I got to the point one day I was so angry. I was so angry at everything. I went to the grocery store, and the bag boy there said something to me, and I barked at him. And I walked out, and I was like, oh, my gosh, this kid did nothing to me. And so, you know, I went back and I said, and I was just like, okay, I got to snap out of it. And then everything shifted. And so I was able to then be more proactive at the time. But I really don't think right at the heart of when things are going on, if we haven't been, we may get lucky. We may be like, you know, a prodigy in equanimity, and it may come up. But most likely there, it just doesn't happen, and we got to kind of just go through it. Yeah. What is that? Take a breath and take a deep breath and take a step forward every day and wait for something to catch up.
Yeah, and meanwhile, we need to try to live in this way with the smaller things
right.
that are more
and not wait.
Manageable,
yeah.
and that will develop our ability.
I would hope a model for equanimity in a case where someone's seriously ill would be the doctors. I would hope they would act with equanimity in solving whatever health problems. So, you know, you could take some clues from the professionals.
Right, that's a good point.
Yeah, the thing is that they are with equanimity because they are indifferent. Actually, in medicine school, they teach you, you don't have to get involved because then you lose that equanimity. And that is what these quotes were talking about. By being indifferent, detached, and not care much, you know, on a certain level, then you can be with equanimity. I think the challenge that we have is to care about things and yet have developed this inner center of poise. And that is far more difficult. But you see, spiritual people, they care deeply for humanity. Jesus, Buddha, or many others. And yet, they can stay in this state of equanimity. If a doctor would get thrown out of this equanimity, would do a mess. So the same happens with us. If we lose our equanimity, we cannot help the people that we love. So having equanimity is the best way to help them. But then it's not easy. As we were saying, it's really difficult in these extreme situations. But the practice will get us closer.
And not going so far as the Buddha or Jesus, but if you go to Mother Teresa, you know, what she was dealing with all the time and things, I think that's a good example of equanimity.
Yeah, that was probably an equanimity based on love and a certain poise, and she was also tending the ill.
Right.
Different from a doctor, normal doctor, where they are taught to be indifferent. So that's the difference.
Okay,
another question. Does the practice of virtue bring wisdom, or does wisdom allow the manifestation of virtues?
There's a quote that says, the practice of virtue is a vice. And what it means is that we can't practice something. It goes back to intention. So if I'm trying to be a vegetarian and every day I want to eat meat, and I'm constantly, no, I'm not spiritual if I eat meat. That is practicing a virtue that I really don't have it in me at all. And that quote was really important to me because I don't think that means that it's useless or it's not useful, but it's a start. You know, I'm aware, as long as I become aware of that difference. But I think with this diagram of meditation, the idea is to tap into that wisdom, and you naturally act with compassion.
Yeah. I think it's a process. I agree that basically when you try to practice something, it's artificial. But then there may be a process, like if you are alcoholic, the first thing you have to do is to get away from alcohol, because you cannot handle to be there. So you are away from it, you push it away. That doesn't mean that you know that you are over, you got over the habit. You are just at the first step is to purge yourself from all this addiction. And then you have to do something else. When you really can get over it, then you can be around people that may be drinking wine and you don't have a problem. So in the process of developing virtue, I think this first step that Michelle was talking about, where maybe you are trying to deprive yourself from something that you feel you are a slave of, is like getting away from it. That is not true virtue, but it may be necessary to give you a space for then begin to try to tap into the higher nature. The idea is we don't defeat the evil by attacking the evil, but by growing in goodness. So the more we can tap into the higher nature, then the virtue will naturally come. But if we are caught into the opposite to the virtue, then we cannot tap into the higher. So the practice of virtues may be this way of diminishing, you know, the non-virtuous emotion. But then we have to work in trying to identify with the higher.
Karma. Are the enlightened beyond karma, or is karma part of the human condition, as is opposite and equal? Goes around, comes around. Mm-hmm. Explain to me karma more. I'm lost with karma.
I'm going to explain my part of it the part of what you said that was helpful for me, that we have these evolutionary stages that we go through. This human stage is one of the stages. The next stage is the superhuman, it's called in some places, or the enlightened stage. So that's a completely different. It's like going from mineral to plant to animal to human to superhuman. So going from animal to human is a completely different evolutionary, you know, stage. And the karma that pertains to an animal is different than the karma that pertains to a human. So I believe that the human stage, yes, there is karma. And the idea is it in Buddhism to break the wheel of karma and to become enlightened or to go to nirvana. And then theosophy says, take it one step further. Instead of hanging out in nirvana, you will come back to the superhuman stage to help humanity.
Yeah, but yeah, the idea, there is karma in humanity, and probably there is karma for the enlightened beings, But it's a completely different kind of karma. It's not a personal karma.
So you don't believe you can ever get beyond karma?
Well, you can get beyond the human karma. And yeah, and then you are an enlightened being, as Michel was saying.
Well, we're just guessing then.
But the idea is that karma is like the ultimate law of the universe. The universe manifests because of karma in a certain, but it's not the human karma. The human karma has a particular quality. It's based on the action of a personal self, and the enlightened being is not identified with the personal self. So that karma disappears. But there, at least in the theosophical view, there is some kind of karma, which we could call it probably something else, because it's not the kind of karma that we know.
For example, when an enlightened being takes on a project, per se, they take on the karma of that project. So the example is Jesus. As he took on or brought Christianity to the world, he took on the karma of Christianity until there are no more Christians left. And I always say that always made me want to go back and study Christianity a little more to help the poor guy out, because there's some heavy karma in there with the life that Christianity has had.
Yeah.
So with it being misunderstood. So I understand that that's one of the kinds of karmas that they take on.
Well, with your son being a diabetic, is that your karma?
And this is what I've learned, especially through that. It's my karma, since he is my son. It's his karma. It's karma of
every country.
Yeah, of the country. Because I looked into it a little more, and I found, you know, the pancreas is related to gluttony. You know, so I definitely didn't raise my kids in a gluttonous manner. So it has to be something that's taken on. It could be family, you know. So there's a lot of little seeds everywhere that come in. So I stopped trying to figure out specifically.
Yeah. Now, karma, you know, we have the tendency to think that karma, each individual is isolated and karma is very individual. But karma is more like a net. It's one thing for the whole humanity and probably for the whole universe. And when you lift, you know, a net somewhere, it will disturb many other points in the net, not only that point. Because ultimately speaking, we are not individuals. We are one being that is expressing itself in different ways and through our different personalities. So there is a personal karma in the sense of, you could say, a concentration. I mean, around this field of consciousness, there is like a concentration of forces that you could say is your personal karma, but it's affecting everything around, and everything is affecting you around too. So in theosophy, there is this concept of collective karma, and many things that happen to you were not necessarily produced by you personally or your higher self, but it's part of what we are in humanity. And then if something good came that you didn't produce personally, then in the future there will be some lack that you didn't deserve to lack. Or, you know, it's the image that we can make. It's much more flexible than simply what a person does, it comes back just like that.
Does theosophy cover reincarnation?
Yeah.
So can you carry karma from a past life?
Yes, that's
it. It is said that what happens to us during this life is from our past incarnation, our past karma. How we deal with it in this life right now affects our future karma.
Yeah, and also that can happen in one life or come from 80 lives in the past, you know. But yeah, we have given some talks about that in the Living Theosophy. We can show you. They are all on the internet, and you can watch those lectures.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so tonight, the diagram, this part of the diagram is called Stepping Above Limitation. And we will begin. So again, the diagram that's been reworked. And just a quick review. So we started the first talk with a sitting meditation. The basis of the sitting meditation was trying to get to that feeling of unity, feeling that we could be expansive or expand ourselves in space and time. And along with that, the states of consciousness. And we had talked about working the states of consciousness as far as paying attention or being aware of what we do physically, our sensations, and being aware of our emotions or our feelings, and being aware of our thoughts. So it's not just automatic that these things are coming and going, but to be aware of them and see how they affect what we do in our daily life. The first acquisition and the first deprivation talked about this substratum of memory that carries that memory of unity with it. And also that once we can access that or clear away the stuff that's keeping us from accessing who we truly are, then that's where courage comes from. And that courage is a higher order virtue. And then the deprivation part is, and this is my new mantra that I say more than once a day now, is a constant refusal to think the reality of whatever's going on, whatever I'm not liking. I'm constantly trying to refuse to think the reality of. And this one was that basically we are not the body and the mind. We are much more than that. And then the second acquisition and the second deprivation talked about the state of mind of equanimity. And that our body has many likes and dislikes. We have very many judgments on things. Sometimes our minds are like that teenager mind where I'm sure I don't like this. I've never tried it, but I'm sure I don't like it because it's a little off or a little different from the pattern that I'm used to. Once we can realize what our bodies are doing in relation to that, hopefully we can break this pattern, we can break these habits, and access some of that equanimity that's out there. Anything to add? Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, so stepping above the limitation, our lower nature, as HPB has said many times, is limited. It's limited by the very nature that we're in the physical world. So just three things I want to go over before we read the quote. One is that we need to be aware that we're only a fragment of this higher self. And the way that I remembered that was if we identify with all that we are here, we're losing so much of what we really are. In the example, I think Pablo's given it before, that if you take a magnifying glass, it magnifies a specific ray of the sun, and we can see that ray. So that ray is who we think we are, but we forget that really we're the whole sun. And usually that little ray is used for like burning leaves or making ants run away. If we think all that we are is that little ray, we're missing out on the part that says that, you know, we're the light that gives life. Oops. We're the light that gives light to the whole world, okay? So that was one thing I want to express is that we are more than just this fragment or just this ray. And then the second one is that throughout this process, it seems like as we learn more, we know more. And that idiom, ignorance is bliss, has a whole lot of meaning in there because it seems like as we get to as we watch our dislikes and likes, I've noticed that I dislike and like everything. I have a judgment on everything. I have very little equanimity. And I'm also more sensitive to that. So when I know that is part of the process that I just have to go through to get to that equanimity, then I can kind of just understand it a little more and follow it through. And then the third thing